From Marigold Cottage. I just want to give a little bit of a share some of my thoughts about this Department of Government Efficiency. Somebody brought to my attention, again, I'm not on top of all of these things because, again, it seems to be playing out exactly like I've talked about for some time. But at the same time, the what works government is still not being incorporated into people's analysis. So I thought I need to come show up again and lay it out for you. And then when I'm done with the overview, I'm going to do a reading of a short story that I found in like 2018 called The Domestic Front. And it was published in Oxford American. It's like a sort of a literary magazine. And it's about smart housing and managed healthcare and this guy who is going through a depressive episode. And recently here I was in conversation with someone and they looked and they said, "So, what do you think of crypto?" Right? And they don't know me. They don't know what I do here. And I said, "Well, it's actually way more than money. They want you to think it's money, but it's actually the signal. And it's a signal within, in my opinion, the creation of this emergent global superorganism that's this sort of biohybrid, parallel, massive parallel processing, interdimensional computation system." And, it's within a group of people who sort of hang on like the Gaia hypothesis thing, not necessarily in a bad way. And so I'm like, it's kind of like that, but it's really about Web3 and blockchain. And so the next question is, okay, well, what is Web3? And I was like, okay, so it's when the internet here in the screen comes out and it's everything in the world that's interconnected and it becomes sort of an logic gate-oriented game board of at a social level, at a societal level, with various key performance indicators and goal-oriented behavior and ubiquitous sensing so that it can like sense all the rounds of gameplay and then feed that back into the loop and work through. And so this is what Web3 is and what blockchain is meant to be, is the signal processing and recording system for all of this. But most people, because it hasn't fully happened, they don't have any kind of framework for understanding it, and it's difficult. It's difficult to process. And so they're listening, and I said, "So, this book, Jamie Wheel's book, Stealing Fire, right? How Silicon Valley and the Navy SEALs, took over America or whatever." And they're talking about essentially the cultivation of ecstasis, this ancient Greek like outlook, which is sort of being in connection with the divine field and the different ways you can get in there and the practices of getting in there, whether that be, substances or extreme sports or crazy sex or different kinds of ways of getting into this field. And really, in my opinion, that's what they're looking to enable at scale and networked as a biohybrid processing system. And I know it sounds crazy, but it's the Stealing Fire book, it's very much documenting all of these developments and then sort of near future projections. And so one of them, and I was telling this person, they're talking about everyone having a 3D printer in their home to on-demand print psychedelics. And they're like, "Oh, like maybe that's not such a bad thing." And I said, "But imagine that these downloads are run by a government agency or a giant in coordination with giant pharmaceutical firms, which are all involved in the legalization space for psychedelics, and your patient compliance of whether you printed the most recent download and utilized that prescription for you for your mental state was attached to your smart door, and the door wouldn't open unless you could prove that you'd been compliant with your medication, right? That had been downloaded into your printer." And this is kind of along the lines of what will be unfolding in this story, The Domestic Front. But most people haven't read stories like that, or they imagine that they're just a story or just a TV show. But I'm saying the Web3 interface of the psyche and the body and the outside-in robot, which is your smart housing, is coming. Like we're on the threshold of that. It's all very possible. It's simply a matter of social acceptance and crafting a story that will allow society to sort of build that in and say, "Well, this is just what our new version of civilization looks like this." And then, of course, we're gonna comply with that. And so getting back to so at that point, they were like, "Oh, yeah, I'm not so sure." And I'm like, "Yeah, see, these are the things that we actually have to talk about." And even in some of these you know, conversations that I've been having locally with people, and they're all like, we should just live in our hearts, right? Not in our heads. Take off our heads and throw them away and just live in our hearts. And I'm like, well, the thing is, the social media feed knows how to get into your heart at this point. Like, it can feed you a story because it knows you well enough to drip, drip, drip the story, so that it's very much like the Hallmark digital media of the world. And if they say, just don't think about it, just don't think, just do, then you're subject to total manipulation. And I'm the first person to admit I probably live way more in my head. And I'm not saying I'm heartless, but I'm very much in my head, probably more than my body. Although in my gardening work now, I'm more in my body, which is a good balance. It's good to be balanced. I'm not saying it should be one or the other, but they neither of them should be thrown out as the wrong one. So I'm saying think about, like, process these systems and think about the potential consequences. Because you might say, this is the most wonderful thing ever. We're going to put all the schizophrenics in tiny houses with 3D psychedelic printers and make them, print out their medication. But by the way, they also have these wearables that are transmitting their access into interdimensional fields and then feeding it into the superprocessor for AI pattern recognition, right? But I don't think that that's a humane thing to do. And I don't agree with it. Again, I don't have personal control over how that's rolling out, but I am saying we need to actually be informed of the possible upsides and the possible downsides, and then openly discuss what this is. But all of this is connected to public assistance. And this is, you know, a drum that I've been beating for a very long time, and something that I found profoundly lacking in the resistance space. In the panic and trauma of the lockdowns and the drum beating of the fear porn around the financial industries and the food system, supply chains, and all these things, pretty much people were operating at that Robert Anton Williams, like, number one biosocial survival state. And so they weren't thinking of other people. Like, they don't really give a shit about, like, Head Start kids or addicts or the elderly, because they just want to know, where can I put my money that my family is going to be safe? And I get that that is an environmental imperative, but that this is really weird. There was like a thumb thing that came up, which I don't even know where that is. That's really strange. Okay, I have to stop this now. That was really weird, like the thumb and then the fireworks. I'm on Zoom and I'm recording this overlaid on Zoom, but I don't know what that was. So again, that's more weird glitches in the matrix of what actually is going on. So these vulnerable populations, these people who are need assistance, because guess what? AI and remote work and remote robotic labor are going to upend the economic stability of many people. And I don't know exactly the time frame. I'm not trying to scare people, but this thing is rolling out within the next generation. It is rolling out. And so there will be more and more people who will rely on assistance networks, but it will be fed through a public-private partnership system. And so I have a little video about blockchain and impact finance. It's from like 2019, 18 or 19. I've had it. It was pre-lockdowns. And I'm saying I have these three hands, like the government, the venture capitalist sector, and the nonprofit sector, which includes the faith communities, that they're all involved, right? So the government is going to monitor your digital identity, right? You will become an asset for investment purposes by the private industry and venture capital funds, and not just the scary bad ones, right? It'll be community banking, right? We're going to be setting up, the move will be towards community banking systems, and we should invest in our people, right? So more and more you'll see the shift to, not the bad kind of capitalism. We want the people's capitalism. We want community banking, right? But that means maybe turning Head Start toddlers into asset-backed securities. And again, is that how we want to run our society? Is that what we're calling civilization in Epic B or Game B? Is that how it's going to work? We should talk about it first. So, and then who's going to implement the assistance? Well, the governments are outsourcing everything, so it will be the nonprofits. And then the nonprofits will be linked to what works impact metrics, and they need to deliver the data. So the data becomes, ubiquitous spatial computing and ubiquitous sensing and children on surveillance play tables in preschool, right? And children in Montessori schools funded by Jeff Bezos who have slippers, sensors in their slippers that create maps of their entire day in the classroom with AI cameras, set up by Sepp Kamvar, Charles Eisenstein's buddy in the cello place. It will look like refugee camps with the same thing, with these social currencies. So it's not going to just be like, I'm really mad at BlackRock. it's going to be like, we have to question, do we want community banking systems that are investing in the commons? And what does that look like under the guise of Web3 spatial computing? And this will feed into the short story that I'm going to read, the domestic front, right? How could these things go wrong? And what are the guide rails? If we're doing it, at the very least, we should come up with some guide rails and have people educated about what is actually happening. Because I have yet to come across anyone, when I explain, I bring up Web3, that even knows anything about what it is. They have no idea. They really have no idea. And the learning curve is pretty high. So the fact that Bobby is in Health and Human Services is important. And I will say, so there's a book by Elizabeth Hinton called From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. And one of the site visits I did, that's Lyndon Baines Johnson's War on Poverty and the social safety net, right? And this is building off of FDR. And so, again, I used to identify as a really good liberal. Like, now I'm out of the box. I'm not identifying with the other side, but I know the story better. And so it turns out this social safety net actually might be a cybernetic fitness landscape, right? Like, run by AI. And it, who know? I don't really know exactly if time is linear or it's all emergent and cyclical. So has it been planned out from the 60s that the social safety net will then be this human potential movement AI training game board? I don't know. I don't know who would know these things or if they're all happening at the same time and then emerging in different ways. But this is what's happening. The social safety net, as Hinton has says, essentially her thesis is that the government assistance programs then opened the door to much more intensive policing of poor communities and predominantly communities of color. So you would get after school programs, but they were connected to the police athletic league. You would get public housing, but it would be full of, again, private, not private, but government, separate standalone government systems to do policing of those people. So incumbent on accessing the benefit, you were subject to more control systems. And unfortunately, Hinton, she's a Harvard professor, so she's not going to talk about impact investing. But in the future, I think that narrative will be set up to say, so we're not going to do that bad kind again. We're going to do more participatory, right? Like where the people have a say and where you live in a smart house and you have an AI twin that's doing voting on radical participatory democracy. And that's the answer. Only is it, right? And so if you're looking at the Great Society, And this dovetails around the same time with the rise of community development corporations. I'm very interested because my background was in historic preservation, particularly in planning. And so how do we protect our historic resources, which I still think is important. But the idea of land trusts and community development in ways that would preserve historic assets, that was my lens, but he didn't really understand how it came out of the Rockefeller Brothers funds and how these community development, the community is the commons, is the landscape of the processor, of the psychic processor. So you manage the community and the built environment to contain and be responsive with our individual bodies and souls and psychic consciousness. Like that, you know, again, did they know this in the 60s? Well, the thing is, if you look back at the Vietnam War, they were working on Internet of Things sensing back then. I mean, the Macy conferences were built off of Tavistock and likely the Society for Psychical Research. So these things, these underlying currents of managed consciousness or harnessing consciousness, I think have always been there. And then how do you create this concept of us buying into community or intentional community, which especially intentional contemplative communities, because when I was working in the space of education, it was all about, you know, workforce development, but AI was going to take over all the jobs. So people should just simply do the things that AI can't do. They should do human things. Well, what is the human thing, right? And they don't come right out and say it, but it seems like the human thing is actually going to be using our soul access to the divine to get into the field, the Akashic records, the quantum space, and pull back information individually and collectively. So the AI goes around and keeps us, you know, in food and water and basic shelter, and then we're supposed to use our assets, our biological and psychic access, to get information and then pull it back out within context, again, using all of our qualia, our perspective on the elephant, to then feed it into a much larger ledger system that parses it out to find patterns and to possibly solve problems, the nature of which I can't quite comprehend at this point. But that's going, all of this, again, the Rockefellers, socialist community development, intentional community, and I have a lot to say about this guy Ralph Borsodi, and who's also connected to like Liberty Lands and permaculture and sovereignty, and this going back to like the 30s and 40s decentralist society backed by Chauncey Stillman, who was a grandson of the Citibank founder and a member of the CIA, was bankrolling these independent decentralist agrarian communities of lifelong learning. And then looking at how this fits in with charter cities. And there was a young guy, he was one of the last presenters at the Mormon Transhumanist Conference. He's Portuguese, and he's working now for the Charter Cities Association. And he was talking about his idea of Harburger Georgism and these smart cities that are cognitive cities. Now, again, there's a very robust, well-developed reality tunnel that's the Agenda 20 run, Rosa Corey, Patrick Wood, technocracy thing about cognitive cities. And you can live inside that space, but generally it doesn't, in my opinion, touch into, it tends to be framed as patriotism and they're doing stuff to us and these dark forces are going to be managing us like puppets. It's not really talking about emergence and complexity, which I find lacking, but you know, to each his own. If that's your reality tunnel, you know, go play there. That's fine. That's not where I am. I can see the infrastructure of that, but I think it's much larger and it needs to be looked at in terms of charter cities. And charter cities are essentially ground up new developments. A lot of them modeled on refugee camps. So emergent, like displaced people who come in and then are, again, they choose. They're not forced. It's not a work camp that they send you to. It's someplace you may be coerced because you don't have other good economic prospects, but you come in the door. And once you come in, you have to live by the rules of the charter city, which is not unlike, like the Catholic monasteries and stuff in California and Latin America, that they would create these safe spaces that were, protected. But if you came in, then you had to live by those rules. And then the rules will be encoded into the built environment. That's the socio-technical cyber-physical system. And then you will be interacting with other people and smart objects in the environment as a hive, you know, as a coordinated social superorganism like the ant colonies and like the beehives, not to make everybody the same, but to cultivate this emergent novelty. And so I feel very close, very, very, my hypothesis, and again, I could be wrong, but that Trump's Freedom Cities concept is going to be modeled on a charter city framework, and it will be a test bed for this. And if you look and you imagine that QAnon is sort of a fully manufactured, mimetic consciousness group, those people would willingly go, if Trump built a freedom city as a charter city model, they would go in there and they would volunteer to go in there. And the volunteering part is also really a huge piece of the Kennedy legacy, is the volunteering, the Peace Corps, the Thousand Points of Light. Ted Kennedy was deeply involved in the social innovation finance space. And so you're doing it for the common good. And I think this piece is really central because, again, in my thought experiment, this networked biological psychic system is built on the power of the heart field, which is the time, the four dimensions, right? Because the heart keeps the time of the body. And entrained hearts are really important. Again, I think that feeds into the contemplative aspect, the mystic aspect, and the mindfulness aspect, and the wearables, the cardio wearables and things that people will have. But entrained hearts are really important. So if a charter city / freedom city / cognitive city / Harbor Georgia's city is the space, and you come in the gate and you join in that, you're doing it for the common good, the collective that you identify with. And that is a halon, right? That's Michaela Uluru's halons. And there would be very many varieties. And I've talked about this for several years, that they're not trying to kill you and they're not trying to make you all the same. They're trying to tag you, organize you as information with others, and then be able to tap upon your holon in the orchestration of the larger computational process. They simply need to know where you are, and you need to be available when, you know, the gong comes in, or the flutes come in, or the violins come in. All of these different holons will be available in the processing system. And that processing system is interrelated by currency. And they will be community currencies, because those community currencies will be the energy exchange within the holon. And that energy exchange relates very much to RFK Jr.'s work in alternative energy space in the solar, which is planned to be on blockchain, decentralized energy systems. And again, the early folks who are working in this pay for success housing finance include the Arnold Foundation of Enron. And Bobby has said his legislation with NRDC helped open the door to the Enron free energy moving around nonsense that happened. But that was one phase, right? A predatory phase of energy motion. But in the larger system, it is going to be the energy exchanging in these holons, sort of tissues in the Gaia noetic superorganism. It's that kind of energy. It's the energy flow of the processor system. And so on the one hand, yeah, it's about your power bill, or, but it's not, it's more than that. It is the signaling to keep the homeostasis of the system as a whole. And I think but the homeostasis of the system as a whole is a cover for the processor. So just going back to social services, you know, I mentioned again the volunteering with the Kennedys and the Peace Corps and their whole legacy of the social good and the social contract and the volunteering. It turns out that RFK, so Bobby's father, he was a lead person in developing the community development space. And I think the first community development agency was in the Bronx. And that's just a stone's throw from Harlem, where they developed the Harlem Children's Zone and this sort of early test bed for social finance tied to venture capital and hedge funds. So RFK Jr.'s in the community development space, right? And then Sergeant Shriver, Bobby's uncle, you know, Shriver's husband, he was essentially the architect for LBJ's Great Society. And so if you understand, again, the Great Society as the underpinning, well, you know, you can go back to FDR, right, the New Deal, and then you've got the Great Society, and that is the core of the socio-technical system. But you need, at this level up with Bobby now, this legacy, you're going to have the digital identity for wellness and the common good and transparency and efficiency, and to run the What Works Government plan, which is what Trump is saying. And so you will be an agent, you know, in this freedom game, right? In the freedom game of holon, choose your holon, right? Volunteer to choose your holon. So your heart will be in the work and you will contribute positively to the orchestration of this giant project. And again, this is all my thought experiment. I could be incorrect, but it's how I'm putting the pieces together. So we'll just sit on the edge of our seats and sort of see what happens. I do want to mention, but Bobby, being with Health and Human Services, he's the guy who's going to be running Head Start and the food stamp program and Medicaid and Medicare and the Health and Human off for a minute. I ran out of disk space. So Bobby's going to be running all of the social programs. And these are the things that are going to be put on blockchain. He's been very clear, he and Trump, about the accountability and government, cleaning the swamp, right, with blockchain. And again, my early work in 2017, 2018 was looking at use cases in the state of Illinois that they were talking about putting SNAP food assistance on blockchain. And again, Sean and I have been talking back and forth about the farmers markets and the food assistance and these digital programs, because in the psychic and computer that I'm proposing, the microbiome is really important. And again, it's inputs and outputs. So what are they putting into you? What investment, either private investors through the government assigned identity systems and impact finance systems vehicles, they're putting things in, which includes food, and what are they getting out? And that's also part of the wellness. So the Department of Agriculture and the food programs are really central. And I can maybe in another video, I'll unpack a map that I did earlier about DC Greens, and it was a program around food prescriptions, food RX. And early on, you know, I was seeing how DuPont was interested in the microbiome space. And it seemed very clear that these food inputs, even the well food, I don't want a food prescription. Like, I don't want a UBI where I have some digital wallet and then I have a certain amount that I have to use for certain kinds of food systems. Because it's also going to be tied to wearables and continuous glucose monitors and metabolism monitors and all of it. Because in order to accept the assistance, you're going to be having to be part of this ongoing data stream of your biology. And again, you're going to have some choice in it, but they're going to create parameters under the guise of personalized nutrition, which again, totally aligns with what Nicole Shanahan is talking about. And to manage your microbiome and your gut microbiome to optimize you for this field access, because a lot of that is through the gut system and through the vagus nerve. It's a fully connected system, and they need to manage the input. So dispossessing people of independent food choices and then putting them onto a game board where they're gamifying their food purchases, whether that be in a traditional grocery store, a food co-op, a farmer's market. You know, it again, I've mentioned John Mackey and conscious capitalism and the guy Rabbi Gaffney and the integral wisdom and all of this stuff, you know. Mackey was, he started the first Whole Foods before it got bought out by Bezos in Austin. So these things have this long history, and this idea of a food prescription tied to your food assistance or tied to your Medicaid is very doable. Like, it's simply, we have to normalize that, of course, this is how we do it now. And of course, it's to be expected that if you accept assistance, that you will have your biology monitored. And often the mainstream press will make it about surveillance or AI, but they're not going to talk about things like remote astral projection, right? And how your microbiome works with that. I think that's going to be off the table for some time, even though it seems pretty clear that since the 70s, that has been part of the conversation of us and our part of the robot, part of the elephant and our qualia. So the food is central, and managing food assistance is central. So, and then a lot of it is connected to health outcomes, and that's the Medicare and the Medicaid piece. So when you're setting up pay-for-success finance, social impact bonds, value-based healthcare, evidence-based medicine, all these different words for it, but data-driven health outcomes under the umbrella of wellness of all these different delivery systems, whether they be alternative health or Rockefeller medicine, they want the data and the evidence to manage the system cybernetically, as cybernetics, worldwide social governance system as the supercomputer. The health cost offsets are going to be a key driver in this. And so one of the main targeted communities is people who are housing insecure, chronically homeless people. A lot of them are veterans, and the veterans assistance also falls under health and human services. So they can experiment on these people with digital identities. I've talked about the MyPass program in Austin that was backed by Johnson & Johnson and Bloomberg to set up digital identities for chronically homeless people. And then the cost offset is reducing emergency room care. And because they say, oh, these homeless people, they overuse emergency room services and it's too expensive. Well, then that is going to be the cost offset for the impact bond deal. And then what happened to the homeless people? Well, they didn't necessarily have a high-tech solution. Their blockchain identity was literally a QR code on a laminated piece of cardstock. They didn't even have a smartphone assigned to them, although that is part of the social assistance systems. And that goes back to Accenture and their work on putting all the government services, you know, your free Obama phone. That it could be a phone, but it could be as simple as a laminated contact paper card that puts you on blockchain. And so these systems have been piloted for at least the past 5 to 10 years, but we're not talking about them because guess what? Oh, those are just homeless people. Like, what, we don't care about them, right? If you have often people who are housing insecure, maybe also are dealing with trauma or have mental illness or addiction situations, and then those people, when things happen to them, can be discounted because they're like, oh, well, you can't really trust them. They're a junkie or what. And I'm not saying this in a cavalier way. I'm saying this is the trope that lets them be sidelined because who's going to be their advocate? And it's similarly with the refugee community. They're dispossessed people. Who is going to be standing up for them, right? There's no one standing in the breach. And even when I was working in Philadelphia, trying to integrate my understandings of what was unfolding with the supposedly outsider housing advocates like Sherry Honkala, they didn't really want to know. They didn't really want to know, even though technically they were supposed to be the nonprofit industrial complex people. And then I turn around and see that people like Sherry Honkala are aligned with Laura George and the Peace Pentagon, who's advocating benevolent AI training with archetypal card games. So what? Are they going to put a bunch of housing insecure people in stack and pack cargo containers and have them play card games to train benevolent AI? Is that our human resources? Is that what we can do as humans is do like astral projection and remote viewing on psychedelics for the government or the Palantir or Peter Thiel or Adam Neumann? Is that what it is? Because I'm really pissed off if that's what it is. And, you know, the sad thing is people are, they're very much tied into their reality tunnel. So if you poke at that and say, wait, there's something more that we need to take into account, they react with a lot of anger. Oh, there's the thing again. They react in a very angry way, which Sherry did. And then again, I transmitted this information back to Jason, and Jason just made apologies for Sherry. He didn't say, you know, her reaction could have been, wow, thanks for letting me know that this Annalise Smitsman that I'm an advisor with to this Peace Pentagon is working on things like this, because I would never do that. She didn't say any of those things. She simply just got mad at me at saying it publicly, like what was happening. So this use of homeless people and people in addiction, which is going to be with Bobby's, you know, wellness centers, mental addiction treatment centers and mental health treatment centers, this is totally aligned with what Palantir is setting up. This is why Thiel and Vance and Trump and Bobby, they're part of this whole other story, which is a cybernetic public investment story that's public running on public-private partnerships to create this biohybrid network system. And the first people on board will be vulnerable populations, right? Head Start kids, many black and brown kids, right? Kids in public school up to grade 3, early childhood education, these impact bonds. The veterans, housing insecure, food insecure, the elderly, these are on the front lines. But if the resistance space isn't really interested, because if you're on the internet all day and doing all these things, maybe you're not a housing insecure person because you have your high-speed fiber connection, then eventually, first they came for those people, then they're coming for you. And so you can't just set this aside and say, well, let me channel some more Catherine Austin Fitz and figure out where to put my money. No, we actually have to care about the whole thing. We have to care about the whole thing because we are part of it. None of us are separate from this thing. Okay, so I'll include a link to the playlist that I did when Jason and I traveled back from the Mormon Transhumanist Conference on Blockchain. And we made our way through Utah, and then we came back to Denver, and I gave a talk in Denver with Jason, and we did some site visits around Denver. Palantir moved their headquarters from Silicon Valley to Denver, I think during COVID, like within the last couple of years. And we did, it's a very low-key building. I did a talk outside the headquarters, and then I did another talk in front of the Capitol building in Denver, discussing essentially why Peter Thiel, you know, a gay Silicon Valley billionaire, became the rainmaker of the Republican Party, and why it was really important that Palantir and Thiel get the Republicans on board with what works government systems, because the liberals and the progressives were already all in on, redistributed commoning with cybernetics. They were not going to be fighting any of the pay for success finance. And so what Thiel needed to do was come up with a story around, you know, sovereignty and freedom and free markets that would bring in the conservatives. And then they're all going to the same destination, but they don't frame the story that way. And so I did several site visits in Denver. Denver, you know, like Texas, is sort of a center of blockchain. Jason had a lot of connections to the East Denver people. And again, Ethereum, when people say, crypto. And I said, no, Web3, blockchain. Well, isn't it about money? No, it's about signal processing. It's about smart contracts. It's about the logic layer, the game board of these fitness landscapes, the network state and the fitness landscapes. So Denver, Colorado is being targeted, and they were early on in a lot of the education reform space. A lot of the people I was trying to organize with in opt out of this testing were from Colorado. And then when I moved into the housing insecurity, Denver was also a center for several pay for success finance deals relating to housing insecurity. And I think one was foster youth and another was just general homelessness. But again, these projects were backed by Rockefeller, Bloomberg, and they're data driven. And I was trying to always get Jason to talk about what was happening in Colorado, right? I'm like, this is your backyard. You know these people. You've been sharing documentaries around social justice issues for forever. Like, why don't you look around your community and start to tell these stories? And again, not that we have to be wrong. There are housing insecurity issues. It's not to say this isn't an issue, but we actually have to start talking about how these narratives of charity are going to be manipulated into something else, something that I find particularly troubling. And that never happened. But Palantir, in the social impact bond space, essentially what they do is they define a cost offset of a social service. They get investors to invest in a program that's supposed to deliver results. They come up with some metrics to say, if you hit this metric target for improved results, the government will have saved X amount of money. And from that pool of savings, we will get our investment back plus a modest return. And so that is how the setup is used. So you need the cost offset. Palantir was, in terms of making sure it's all on the up and up, right, you need a third party that verifies the results. So Palantir, in the early pilots in Santa Clara, California, there were four early pay for success / social impact bond pilots. Two of them were for early childhood education and literacy. And then there was another one for mental health and then another one for homelessness. And the mental health was called Partners in Wellness and the homelessness one was called Welcome Home. And those were social impact bonds. And they were in connection with the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center. And Palantir was the deal verifier there. And so they were working on medical records. Now, this is going to be tied to your electronic health record, and that electronic health record is your digital twin. And your digital twin is going to be used for this impact verification. Again, it's coming for vulnerable communities first, but it totally dovetails with Bobby's plans for the rolling out the San Patrignano model globally. And if you think about Palantir, you know, it's the all-seeing eye, right? And if you imagine the all-seeing eye is a fitness landscape, right? There's a key performance indicator for human ascension or human optimization. And then we're constantly feeding data in and sifting through things that amplify the performance or bring it down. And then we jettison the stuff that brings it down. And then we keep improving, right? Supposedly, or quotes on the improving. But this fitness landscape, I think, is the Palantir, is the system that is keeping an eye on everything towards these optimization metrics under, again, what works government. And I'm not about government bloat or inefficiency, and I'm not here to say the government's perfect, but this system involves all parties, right? The government provides access, the private sector provides the capital, the nonprofit sector, including many faith communities, are providing the social welfare services. So all of them are integral into this, and I talk about this in my blockchain video. So Denver is a center for this. Again, you know, Jason, if you're still paying attention, like, I'm waiting to hear what you have to say about this stuff. It's important, and Palantir moving to Denver was significant. And again, we already went there and talked about it. I can remind people, I can insert that thing here at the end so you can listen to me talking about Palantir, and that's the Vance part of this. Let's see. Oh, the other piece, so we've got Musk. You know, I've already did that whole discussion about Musk and AI and Twitter, but we also have Vivek Ramaswamy who's involved here, and sort of the low-hanging fruit is, you know, biotech venture capitalists. Well, yeah, that's great for wellness, right? Like having that guy up with Musk on the government efficiency project. But what I found a little disturbing is when I was looking at his Wikipedia, it mentioned an episode a couple years ago where they had a closed door session where he was pitching to run the government pension system of the state of South Carolina. And that was concerning for a lot of people. And what draws my attention to that is that actually South Carolina was the initial pilot for pay for success finance for maternal health care. And it was through Medicaid. So poor women who were in South Carolina were voluntarily put on a program, on an app, to get parenting information, good parenting information. And this app was developed by Pam Omidyar, the wife of Pierre Omidyar, who's doing the One World Good ID. And Pam was setting, she runs this medical tracking system called Hope Lab. And so these poor mothers were supposed to interact with this app. And again, it was voluntary, but the backers, including, I think, the Duke Endowment, which is, you know, again, J.B. Ryan and Parapsychology, and Google, and Medicaid was all part of this. So Bobby's fingers are going to be all in this kind of stuff, right? And since my initial looking at this, I'm realizing that if they're after the children, because the children have a particular connection to the field. They haven't been fully domesticated yet, right? That the fetuses are really between worlds, right? That the unborn child in the womb is floating in the water, is both of this world, but of the divine world beyond. It's in this liminal space. And so when I was doing my research about the conditional cash transfers in Mexico in the 90s, now this is pre-digital UBI, but early, it seems to me very clear that they're setting this up. Now these conditional cash transfers tied to maternal health care, and especially health disparities for Black and brown women, they were saying, okay, we're doing telemedicine now with this high-tech remote telemedicine. And here, put this phone on your pregnant womb. Right? Put this electromagnetic device on your womb. Now, we compare that with Mary Lou Jepsen and her infrared scanning phone systems, and we have to wonder, what is this all about, right? This pay-for-success finance where you're getting into vulnerable communities and especially pregnant women of color, and you're sticking these devices on them and you're connecting these apps to them. Yeah, it's voluntary. To what end? At some point, are you going to happen to have a certain score to take your baby home if they're born in the hospital? If you don't meet the app score, your child gets put into protective services, and who knows what happens to them at that point. It's very troubling. And so the fact that Ramaswamy was pitching South Carolina pension management, which is, you know, there was pushback from the state of South Carolina on that pay for success finance system. And so it was very shocking to me to see that this is how this is rolling out. So I'm just not sure what to say about that. But all of these pieces are coming into place. And I guess in my notes, this is one other thing I want to mention, the Housing First policy. So the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, like the Housing, I learned about Housing First through them. It really got started in like 2005 in Utah, which should send up some red flags, right? Utah is a center for industrial banking. Goldman Sachs is central. Goldman Sachs is also central in the social impact bond space. And the idea on Housing First is that it's unconditional housing. You don't have to meet any certain requirements. They'll just put you into housing. Now, I get that you shouldn't have all of these hurdles to meet to get the housing, because a lot of people have unmanaged addiction, other things going on. But in reality, if what you're doing is creating networks of outside-in robots to mine the poor for data for impact finance deals, then I have problems with that. We need to have a broader conversation. And so, you know, embedded within the state of Utah is also the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I think it's significant, you know, again, Ancestry.com was based there, and then they got bought out by Blackstone, which is the largest single family private property rental organization, and they bought Ancestry.com. So how is it that then you have your housing, which is your environment, linked to your biology, linked to industrial banking systems, linked to impact finance bonds? You know, and it brings to mind, there's, you know, again, they often disclosure through the television shows, and I don't watch a lot of TV, but early on people were talking about the, I don't know, it was 15 or 50 million merits, where essentially they have people who are trapped in these little cells, and then they have to ride bikes and watch ads on TV to power the system and earn their credits, right? And their little cells are lined, walls lined with screens. It's very similar. And then in the second episode, second season of the OA, they have this collective, these women brought in to do collective dreaming in front of this vibrating pole, and then with transcribers sitting there transcribing all of their dream states. And so I feel like these are hat tips to what is coming with using our built environment as this responsive environment to harvest our energy. But I don't think it's going to be they're going to force you into a camp. I think they're going to create intentional communities with narratives that will invite people in, and then they will willingly participate. And at the end of the day, I guess, you know, if you're an adult person, then it's up to you to decide how you want to spend your life. But I think in the health and human service space, again, because the health and human services is working directly with HUD, Housing and Urban Development, on the Pay for Success Finance. And again, so we have Bobby Jr., the son, fulfilling the community development role of the father, RFK Jr., the father, and then Sergeant Shriver, the uncle, in the Great Society space. It's just this string that's pulling. And I'm not even saying that Bobby necessarily even knows this. I mean, there's parts of me that thinks, is this emerging out of the field? Is there some blueprint for how this is happening? And people are just filling in their little parts of, you know, coloring in their parts of the drawing page, and they don't really know what the picture is on the puzzle box, you know? I'm not here to assert blame. I'm simply saying this is the trajectory of cybernetic government in the name of efficiency. But as I mentioned before, I don't think technocracy is the best use, because I think what they're after is emergence. So it's not micromanagement. It's a management for the catalyzation of novel information from the field. And it's communitarian in that it is the commoning, but it's not just amatai et sioni. That's, again, anyone who just wants to pin, like, take it back to a particular thing and say, oh, look at me. I found it. I found the bad guys. They're here. It's Doge. Oh, it's Venice. Those are the bad guys over there. That's not, in my opinion, that's not enough. We actually need to start to process the overall network, the policy system network, without applying a label. Because as soon as you pin it down and apply a label, then you're stuck. Then essentially you just pull everything into that one reality tunnel and set it there. Anyway, I think that's all I have to say about Bobby and Health and Human Services and revisiting social impact finance and how it relates to, you know, token engineering of public assistance benefits and impact finance. Again, if you come across anybody else talking about this angle of it, please send it to me, because, like, I'm not plugged into the feed, and I would love to know that there are other people talking about it in this way without trying to pin it on one particular group. It is a legacy system. And it enfolds so many aspects of the resistance, right? The sacred economics, the community currencies, the decentralization, you know, the wellness systems. It's all of these things that we have been brought along, our consciousness along, for the past 4 years, that's laying out the way into the Hubbard George's Freedom City. And the question is, like, do you walk in the gate? Do you walk in the gate? Do you know what you're walking into in that game board? So I'm going to ring off here now, and then later this afternoon I am going to upload a reading of The Domestic Front, which really clearly lays out sort of a scenario of smart housing run by your insurance company and what this looks like. And again, I read this back, I think, in 2018, and this is what has informed a lot of my outlook as this is all unfolding. It's not new. It's, at this point, it's 6 years old. You know, I'm not even saying that this is, like, disclosure. It's simply conjecturing on what the Web3 ubiquitous spatial computing for your own good, for your own wellness, would look like. And then we have to get into the space of talking about it. And, you know, I did do a read aloud before of Cory Doctorow's novella Radicalized. And I'm trying to remember the name of there's four short vignettes, novellas in that collective. But one was essentially about the outside-in robot and refugee communities and affordable housing. So this is all linked not just to maybe stack and pack, you know, traumatized people in addiction who are housing insecure, but it's also increasingly going to move into the workforce housing program, whether you be cops or teachers or firefighters or places where the housing prices have been driven so astronomically high that they're developing sort of mixed use planned cities a la Adam Newman and Mark Andreessen, the flow cities that are integrated cybernetic systems for the middle class, or what we used to be the middle class and now is just workforce. And I think increasingly workforce will be psychic workforce, heart-based psychic workforce. So, all right. Bye, everybody.
UCSF and the PFS program is that we help design the randomized controlled trial study design, and we're the program evaluator for the 6.25-year project. So one of the challenges in working with administrative data is that data are often siloed from one another. So healthcare data don't speak to behavioral health data, don't speak to data from the jail system, and often those don't speak to housing data. And especially for chronically homeless individuals who are interacting with all parts of a county system, you really need all those data sources to get a complete picture.
One of the biggest challenges that we face in trying to better utilize our data is complying not only with all the legal protections that must be complied with very thoughtfully in order to utilize that data, and that's been a consistent challenge that we've faced, that other governments around the country have faced, and we knew we had to figure out a solution for.
When Palantir was approached for this project, we knew we had to do it. It was right at the intersection of the type of projects we like to work on. First, there's a clear need for data and better data infrastructure. Second, it's mission-oriented and socially impactful. Third is that it really values outcomes, which is core to Palantir's philosophy. And fourth, it's right in our backyard. Palantir built an integrated data platform that links across key social services databases to provide a holistic view of homeless clients within the county. So now Abode, UCSF, and the county can all log into the system and see not only real-time how the program's tracking, but also be able to look at trends and do analyses on how to make social services better in the future.
Teal has been identified in recent years as sort of a political rainmaker for the Republican Party, which is interesting to me because, you know, he's a Silicon Valley guy. And on the surface, it doesn't necessarily seem to be, you know, a great match with the Republican Party. But I think it's important to understand that moving forward, the whole technological social engineering element that's advancing tied to digital identity and what works government, they really need the conservatives on board, because really the last 2 years have shown that the liberals and the progressives don't get that the underpinning of these social impact markets is really very devious and not meant to actually help people. Despite these terrible power imbalances and the rollout of this militarized technology, that things are going to improve for vulnerable populations. And I can't begin to explain why they think that is, but there's been no indicator over the last 2 years that the progressive liberal left is going to come along anytime soon. The biosurveillance state needs to pull in the conservatives. So then in that context, I think it makes sense that Peter Thiel is being that rainmaker at the moment, and that there's such an emphasis within the blockchain crypto space to be going after red states or sort of purple states like Colorado. Get them on board with this understanding that somehow these decentralized technologies are going to preserve their rights and their access to free markets. When really the free markets are not going to be for your everyday person, it's going to be free markets for AI-driven hedge fund portfolios. That Peter Thiel actually purchased he has multiple homes in multiple places, but he did purchase an $18 million mansion in Miami. You know, Miami, in Florida in general, and Miami specifically, are very much aligned with the crypto blockchain space. The Learning Economy Foundation, their test lab for digital education and human capital finance, one of the test beds is here, C-Lab in Colorado, and then the other one is actually in Broward County, which is sort of just outside of Miami. So Miami is sort of the crucible for a lot of the blockchain space and a launching pad for what's happening in Central America and Latin America in that space.
Okay, so we're here on Blake Street in downtown Denver. As I was looking for places to do field work here in the Colorado area, I had a friend alert me to the fact that actually Palantir had relocated its headquarters from the Bay Area here to Denver. And it's the building behind us. the address given on their website says Suite 250. So it's sort of low-key, given the scope of Palantir in larger government accounting and geopolitical frameworks, because I feel like they're going to play a significant role in sort of the ubiquitous surveillance, tracking, social impact space. But yeah, again, it's very low-key, and I was mentioning to Jason as we walked up, I'm like, it's kind of a small building. And he made the point that really, you know, discreet is probably what they're going for at this point. And like, the future of work is that you're working from your sofa or your kitchen table, not actually in a physical office. So, you know, a huge organization like this could occupy a rather small footprint downtown rather than necessarily a big office complex sort of in the suburbs part of the city. So I thought that was an interesting observation. And then our next stop is going to be at the Capitol, and we're going to talk a lot about the state of Colorado and digital citizenship, digital government, and as it links to pay for success finance. But here for Palantir, I wanted to raise the issue that early on in my research around education, Santa Clara County, California, which is in the Silicon Valley area, was the testbed for a number of pay for success finance social impact bond deals. It was sort of a mixed bag. Some were strictly pay for success, some were formal social impact bonds. They included an early childhood social impact bond, an early literacy social pay for success deal, and then also two social impact bonds, one for homelessness and one for mental health. Now, those latter two, the homelessness social impact bond, which was called Welcome Home, and the mental health one, which was called Partners in Wellness, within the pay-for-success finance space, you always have a third party that does the deal evaluation. So you have an arrangement between investors, the public agencies, and then there are supposed to be certain target metrics hit in order to fulfill the terms of the deal. And so in the case of both of those two, the homelessness and the mental health social impact bonds, Palantir was actually the third party reviewing. And if you understand Palantir's connections with State Intelligence, Defense Department, Homeland Security, one of their early funders was InQtel, which is the venture capital arm of the CIA, you can imagine how you have these vulnerable communities that need social supports, and then all of a sudden they become sort of sucked into this data vortex where their lives and behaviors become enmeshed in finance deals that are overseen by an entity that has very diverse interests, and many of them that, you know, are maybe at odds of just the general dispossessed poor person that needs the services. So, you know, I wanted to bring that up. The other element, so Palantir does some of their work as pro bono. They have an philanthropy division, and they call it philanthropy engineering, right? And so, again, we're looking at sort of social progressivism, this continuation from, you know, the late 19th, earliest 20th century of engineered society to certain specifications. But right now, the specifications that society is going to be engineered to will be in alignment with investors, right? The BlackRocks of the world, the Vanguards of the world, the State Street Capital. Society will be reshaped to meet the needs of global capital. And Palantir is playing a role both in facilitating the assessment of the deals, but then also in implementing a larger state surveillance component that was going to be linked to your digital identity. So I want to mention, so Peter, and I'm not sure if it's Thiel or Thiel, I'm not sure the correct pronunciation, T-H-I-E-L. He was the founder of PayPal. And so a lot of what's going to be advancing moving forward is that my sense is that the pay-for-success deals will be linked in with conditional cash transfers. It might take the form of like a universal basic income or a cash payment system. But those payment systems, it's very obvious now that they're going to be digital. It's not going to be bills in your wallet. It's going to be digital credit on a phone or other smart device, or potentially in some future some sensor that's in your hand, you know, or, you know, biometric tattoo or something. And then the money in those systems can be programmed and linked to smart contracts to be used only for certain functions. Like, here's your public benefit, but you can use X amount for rent. You can use X amount for food. You can use X amount for reskilling. You can use X amount for mental health services. And you'll have very little autonomy in that equation, though there will likely be some, because these betting markets are going to be betting on your behavioral compliance. So the money that comes will be sort of monopoly money. And then That's sort of the starter money for the game of life. I will mention those social impact bonds that were happening in Santa Clara County, Partners in Wellness and Welcome Home, also had ties to the University of California, San Francisco Medical Complex. And so, you know, we talked in Salt Lake City about the interface between predictive profiling of mental illness, of how that relates to social impact finance. Illness and addiction, how it meshes with the finance deals and how it will mesh with wearable technology and potentially remote sensing technology, right? Because what they were doing at the Huntsman Center was they were planning to use these MRIs to sort of tease apart the neurons to identify whether you were prone to depression or schizophrenia or addiction. They were looking to get very nuanced data to fund these deals tied to mental health. In my mind, that's a problem when what we're doing is we're playing a giant game. Now, I will say the year or so before the lockdown started, one of the first deployments of digital identity in this country happened in Austin, and it was part of the ID 2020 program. You know, everyone has a good digital identity, good ID, that's backed by Pierre Omidyar. That program was called My Past in Austin. It was funded by the Robert Woods Johnson Foundation and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Bloomberg is also active in the Pay for Success finance space here in Denver. And so what they did was they put unhoused people on blockchain for their medical records. And in that case, it was not high tech. It was simply that each person had their biometrics taken and they were assigned like a laminated card QR code that would represent them digitally as a citizen. So it doesn't have to be something as fancy as like they're going to put a chip in your hand. It could really be something as simple as a laminated QR code, which now like we've all started to become accustomed to, that that's where things are moving. So I think we need to consider that in light of pay for success finance deals, the kind that Palantir was involved with. And here in Denver, they actually have a pay-for-success deal for the homeless, and it's connected to both Housing First services and something called Assertive Community Treatment. And I'm not totally familiar with that, but that's an interesting name, Assertive Community Treatment. There was an article on this in the Urban Institute's website, and partners included the Denver Foundation, the Python Foundation, now Gary Investments, the Walton Family Foundation, John and Laurel Arnold Foundation. Now, again, John Arnold was Enron, Energy's futures trading, and he actually got caught in Baltimore doing sort of illicit deals with the city council to do surveillance flights of the city tied to predictions around crime. So that's part of that. Living Cities, that's a Rockefeller program tied to smart city development. The Nonprofit Finance Fund, which was very central in all of the Santa Clara deals with George Overholtzer. Colorado Health and Northern Trust. So there's multiple partners in that. Harvard Kennedy School was providing technical support, as well as Colorado Access, which I understand is Colorado's sort of Medicaid health system. Services were provided by Corporation for Supportive Housing and Enterprise Community Partners. And the payer on that deal was the City and County of Denver. It was about a five-year program that was starting in 2016. So again, Housing First is a model where you people who are in crisis, you get them in housing, and then you try to take care of their needs, which on the surface I don't have a problem with. But if what we're building is potentially smart housing with sensors, with conditional money, with non-consensual services provided to people, where there's surveillance involved and where those people then become commodities in global markets, that becomes a problem. I think that ethically, that's a huge problem. Then what we have is poverty and trauma that creates money for the wealthiest people in the world. And that's not going to fix the problems. If you have profitable poverty management, you're simply going to grow more poverty. So, you know, Palantir's role in all of this, if they continue with what they had done in Santa Clara County, will be to assess those deals and possibly provide impact data, I'm assuming, to fulfill them. Now, earlier, maybe like 3 years ago, there was a program that set up opportunity zones, and every governor was supposed to identify 20% of its low-income census tracts to be identified for these opportunity zone areas. And they were for redevelopment, essentially, it was a way for global financial interests to come in and gentrify huge swaths of land, make investments in both real estate and businesses. And these could include NGO service providers like charter schools, maybe like wellness providers, counseling, various companies. And if they could hold their investment for up to for 10 years, they would never pay capital gains tax on their original investment, which is a huge windfall. And these are like portfolios. It's really only these really big companies that have the resources to like sit on their investment for 10 years, but they totally can do that. So they can come in, remake whole neighborhoods. There are no protections from gentrification for the local people. And this is very much connected with the Federal Reserve's redevelopment programs, both community development of infrastructure and human resource development tied to reskilling. So in 2019 in Philadelphia, our Federal Reserve office, led by Patrick Harker, with our former mayor, Michael Netter, who's a Bloomberg What Works government guy, they came together with this Pathways to Prosperity program. I'm going to wait until it goes. Okay, so there is this Pathways to Prosperity program, which was essentially reskilling workers into things like commercial laundries, or they were partnered with Comcast, which is the telecom provider, because someone has to do the wiring for the metaverse and the surveillance state. And so they were reskilling. Now, this was pre-lockdowns, right? Many people of the middle class losing their jobs in the lower class and then having to reskill for the fourth industrial revolution. So the central banks interconnected with the opportunity zones are really, really central. And probably a lot of this redevelopment is going to be linked to smart systems, a smart infrastructure. They will come into low-income communities, probably like level it out, and then just start from scratch and rebuild what essentially might sort of be like friendly gulags, right, of social impact support systems. And so it's interesting here in Denver, there's an area that's sponsored by Panasonic. It's out near the airport. It's on the border of sort of a large opportunity zone on the east side of the city. And this Peña Center is on a transit hub. They're piloting autonomous vehicles, piloting smart pavement, piloting smart street lights that they've said will advertise to you based on your personal profile. And Panasonic did a previous city outside of Tokyo. So you can imagine that these opportunity zones would be remade specifically with supportive housing or mental health or services involved. But, you know, it's going to be conditional. It's going to be conditional on your behavioral compliance. And it's going to be tied in with, programmed money and your QR codes, which we'll talk about later, but, your digital identity. And Colorado is coming up with its own, your identity on a smartphone with you having to show proof of things like, your health status in order to access parts of society. And I can imagine these opportunity zones will be test beds. The homeless, people who have mental illness will be early pilots for this. This will be profitable, and they will work out the kinks for the larger program, and that they will then apply to smart cities, charter cities, special economic zones. Essentially, with geofencing, you can just, it's the Wild West. You can just carve out parts of a city, and companies can take it over and do whatever they want in there, and that's where we're at. So anyway, new low-key headquarters of Palantir behind me in downtown Denver.
Blockchain, life on the ledger. We can make money off your life, the data of your life, even when you have no money of your own. In coming years, millions of people will be issued digital identities, whether they choose to or not. These identities, also known as self-sovereign or decentralized identities, will capture information about a person's interactions with other people, the government, public services, and also with the built environment via Internet of Things sensors. Examples of the Internet of Things, or IoT, include smartphones, tablets and laptops, smart utility meters, trash cans, streetlights, sensors embedded in bikes, street furniture, playground equipment and pavement, EasyPass transponders, barcodes, QR codes, and RFID chips embedded in ID and payment cards, and even in a person's body.
Life will be recorded as a series of transactions on blockchain. Each digital identity becomes a shadow self comprised of data. Some data points are significant, like a birth certificate. However, many other bits of data will be used to fill out the shadow self, bits most people aren't even conscious they're creating. These bits are simply metadata, exhaust thrown off as we live our routine, digitally mediated lives. Blockchain is a decentralized ledger created in computer code and shared across networks. It cryptographically manages coded data and digital assets using public and private keys. Western interests under the guise of philanthropy are using blockchain to continue a brutal legacy of colonial exploitation. In July, the world's first blockchain baby was born in Tanzania. The baby's healthcare costs were recorded in a digital ledger, establishing its fundamental indebtedness. Aid Tech, an NGO, assigned baby and mother digital identities. Farm Access, another NGO, added the first round of data, logging their development aid provided prenatal care on blockchain. Global philanthropic interests are using blockchain to undermine local control regarding aid distribution. This enforcement mechanism of programmable money perpetuates the false notion that recipients of resources cannot be trusted to make independent decisions about their lives and what is best for their communities. NGOs assert blockchain is needed to secure the development aid supply chain against fraud. In this way, blockchain may be considered the newest paternalistic financial control mechanism, one that ultimately serves to concentrate wealth, data, and human activity in the hands of financiers, who attempt to mask the brutality of the social control and surveillance program through strategic use of language around accountability, transparency, and impact. Authorities register transactions such as these in order to claim returns on human capital investments. Care is not offered as a fundamental human right, but conditionally. The unspoken expectation is that recipients must produce positive responses to interventions as quantified by narrow data-driven success metrics in order for financial rewards to flow to service providers and social impact investors. Within the context of these free markets, the bodies of the poor, especially Black and brown people, can be legally subjugated through these financial control systems. Human relations of mutual aid are remade as transactions of technologized violence. This Tanzanian baby is a harbinger of mass digital servitude. It heralds a future where bodies could be managed as wards of the global corporate state, groomed for the data they produce, their personal agency stolen. In an era of climate catastrophe, economic turmoil, and militarized violence, there is deep, deep poverty, and millions of refugees are on the move. Financiers will use blockchain, biometric tracking, big data, risk prediction, and digital payments to manage the dispossessed, establish their group indebtedness, and profit from the misery of indentured populations. Concentrated wealth and prolonged austerity have decimated the purchasing power of the masses. Money is out of reach. People can no longer be compliant consumers. Deprived of stable employment, food, and shelter, many communities can't buy enough products to keep capital moving. Therefore, they are being pressured to become products themselves. Blockchain will incorporate the poor via their data into global value chains, their lives reduced to raw material, processed by poverty management systems to fuel the machine of late-stage capitalism. Financial backers of universal basic income propose that digital currency, like Grantcoin or ManaBase, be distributed on blockchain ledgers. The free money can thus be distributed with strings attached. Acceptance of life-sustaining funds or services will demand compliance with behavior management systems overseen by global monopoly capital. Dissent will not be tolerated. Dissent may result in your digital identity being flagged or erased altogether. The masters of tech and finance are trying to convince the public that blockchain will be a gift of empowerment, knowing that the only power it will actually give people is to sell their human capital at a loss. We need a counter-narrative that explains how this might actually work. Smartphone apps built on blockchain technology permit the exchange of data and currency. non-monetary digital assets can be identified using colored tokens. Access is often provided through a digital e-wallet secured using biometric authentication from fingerprints, retinal scans, facial recognition, vascular patterns, or even one's heartbeat. E-wallets store health records, education credentials, birth certificates, voting records, land ownership records, public benefit access, rights and privileges, cryptocurrency, and any other debt or asset that can be represented virtually by a token. Note, e-wallets record tokenized debt. Impact investors need for us to adopt technologies like these wallets that create interoperable data exchanges. Such platforms will allow them to track impacts across different aspects of a person's life. For example, did the education intervention they invested in also yield benefits to a person's health or housing status? They want credit for that. Did the health intervention for a child improve their education and workforce outcomes? They want credit for that. They need all of the data in one place to enhance the data analysis and predictive analytics for future investments. They want all the credit for conducting micro-surveillance of our lives, and they are using blockchain to say that all of the data is private and thus we shouldn't mind. Financial titans hope blockchain can catalyze widespread adoption of pay-for-success government contracting as an efficient platform for data capture and exchange of debt and profit. But success must first be redefined in simple data-driven terms that serve social impact investment markets. In this game, success simply means moving numbers in the correct direction on a data dashboard. Concepts like growth, value added, and impact are not about helping people actually obtain a better quality of life, but simply a means by which to turn life into numbers. Numbers to serve the global financial gambling syndicate, not people in need. Once metrics are set, human services like healthcare and education will be reverse engineered so that aggregated data will automatically trigger impact payments to global banking interests after verification is made on blockchain. A few examples. A pregnant mother signs up for an online parenting webinar. It becomes logged on an app. There's a token transfer. A baby hits a target weight goal. Log in on an app. Token transfer. A toddler attends a day of preschool. Log in on an app. Token transfer. A student uses their educational savings account, checks in at a community makerspace, token transfer. An opportunity youth, a high school dropout, as yet unemployed, is awarded an industry credential, token transfer. A pre-diabetic patient meets their Fitbit target for the month, token transfer. A person who has been incarcerated completes an online behavioral therapy program. Token transfer. A veteran participates in a virtual reality therapy session. Token transfer. A person with unstable housing registers for a digital wallet. Token transfer. Digital platforms like an electronic health record will algorithmically monitor service providers and clients for compliance, nudging their actions towards the cheapest method of delivering the agreed-upon impacts. The process could be managed through smart contracts that are legal documents written in computer code. These contracts automatically transfer payments to and from electronic wallets after assurances that agreements have been met are entered into the blockchain ledger. However, blockchain systems could be used to discipline those needing services. For example, an Internet of Things pill cap indicates a pregnant woman is not regularly taking prenatal vitamins. She is logged as non-compliant and finds it nearly impossible to get a follow-up appointment. A baby does not hit a developmental milestone, and the family is compelled to accept an in-home monitoring system. Parents refuse to enroll their toddler in a subsidized franchise preschool and are flagged by the Department of Human Services as being at a heightened risk of neglect and subjected to a program of home visits.
Behavioral biometric algorithms send erroneous cheating alerts to parents of hundreds of cyber high school seniors whose transcripts are held pending outside review. An apprentice at an advanced manufacturing plant falls ill, is unable to scan in for 2 weeks, and is subsequently barred from completing the program or enrolling in other comparable training. A diabetic patient falls and twists her ankle. Unable to meet the activity level required by her fitness tracker, her insurance company denies her claim to cover replacement therapeutic shoes. A person who is incarcerated completes their online education modules, but does it inconsistently. This triggers a problematic behavior code that results in the person being denied parole. A veteran finds that virtual reality goggles prescribed to treat her chronic depression instead make her feel ill and disoriented. After discontinuing the assigned treatment protocol, she has refused access to other non-digital therapies. An elderly man who has unstable housing misplaces his smartphone, and even when he has it, he gets anxious about using the benefits app. He often goes hungry because he is nervous about being turned away at the community feeding center. Tokenizing human behavior so that it can be placed on blockchain and subjected to control by algorithms is a dehumanizing process grounded in digital surveillance and micro-oversight. It pushes social and financial relations onto devices to ease collection of impact data for pay-for-success contracts. Ruthless financiers oversee at arm's length systems that have been structured to break people and then profit from so-called fixing the victims on the cheap, awarding them sub-market pay for their labor, and supplying just enough income to keep them from dying. Meanwhile, complicit nonprofits and benefit corporations beholden to corporate philanthropy provide quote-unquote successful services that will push volumes of data onto blockchain. They will work hand in hand with the government to outsource public services through pay-for-success contracts. Entities like Strive Together, a national partnership program, will be one of those gearing up to coordinate wraparound services for so-called community schools. That is simply how this machine will work. It will be carried out with innovative voucher programs like digital education savings accounts or health accounts. Digital wallets will serve as gatekeepers, controlling access to public services and monitoring all of the data to determine what, quote unquote, works. As the grip of big data tightens, global finance enthusiastically pitches blockchain as a way for precarious workers to mine value from their souls. They want to frame it as a choice. Become an entrepreneur, curate your precarious life, and sell your personal brand to targeted marketing campaigns and philanthrocapitalists. Meanwhile, the government and their private security consultants would monitor your digital footprint for evidence of disillusionment and dissent, adjusting your opportunity score accordingly. Would the poor have a choice about how their blockchain data is accessed? Can the masses refuse to be reduced to an impact metric? Will the wealthy be the only ones to be able to lock down their data ownership in perpetuity? With Swiss bankers, venture capitalists, technology interests, and foundations plotting out futures for blockchain babies, a counter-narrative is required. These are my musings on what it might mean to live life on the blockchain ledger. Picture a warehouse, one with infinite storage capacity. Everything in it is indexed, searchable, and ready for analysis. A child's first set of shelves in their warehouse is populated with data from family members. That data determines a baby's initial human capital score. Systems crunch the data to predict the amount of services that will be required to fix the child to serve the needs of the machine, and therein lies the investment opportunity. Days and years pass with digital dust filtering steadily into each child's warehouse, off-gas bits of data from the life monitoring technologies in their homes, classrooms, doctors' offices, libraries, cars, and even playgrounds. Layers of data build up, each bit insignificant on its own, the full value of the deposit realized only after it has become deep enough for mining. Where a person goes, how they travel, what they buy, what level of education they attain, what skills they have, the nature of work they do or don't do,
the amount of debt they carry, the public services they consume, if they maintain their health, if they have problems with addiction, if their housing is insecure, if they have entanglements with the law, the relationships they maintain, their social network, layer upon layer, growing deeper and deeper. Access to that data is through a locked door open with a biometric key. Each door features an individual avatar and three numbers that change as new data is added. The first number is a risk score, a prediction about how closely the person will conform to social norms. The second number is an opportunity score, a prediction of how easily the person can be molded to meet those norms based on their response to past interventions. The third number is an impact score, a number representing the cumulative return on public investment that have been made in that indentured individual to date. The three numbers feed to a digital barcode. Next, imagine there exists an Uber warehouse that contains all of the other warehouses and is patrolled by automated AI investors with scanners looking to maximize profit on social impact investment portfolios. These capital for good AI investors roam the warehouse, scanning the variables on all the doors to determine whether or not an individual merits being added to a portfolio, and if so, what level of investment is possible. If you are a very wealthy person who has no need for public services, including public education, perhaps you turn off access to your numbers. This protects you from scrutiny, and your data never needs to be opened up to anyone. If you're a person who's managing but needs access to job opportunities or to upgrade your position, your numbers are open to field offers from investors. And if you obtain an attractive arrangement, you may be willing to sign on to a smart contract and negotiate how much access to your impact data you will allow. But say you're a desperately poor person, or even worse, a person with a low return on investment, perhaps someone deemed too risky. There is no profit in people who are labeled unfixable. And in such cases, that door is left wide open in case an investor might wander in, look around, and offer some scraps of value in return for your data. Blockchain is not a tool of freedom, but rather one of discipline and domination. As a mechanism of social control, it will be used to push lean production. As a mechanism of innovative finance, it will intensify artificial intelligence-mediated algorithmic trading. As a mechanism of predictive profiling, it will amplify structural racism and escalate the ongoing oppression of Black and brown communities. While blockchain is presented as a perfect method by which to monetize the data of our lives, we must pause and consider if that is the type of life we actually want. Do we want to be isolated from one another, competing for increasingly scarce resources, our only relations tied to currency transactions? We can still choose to reject it. We can elect instead to build systems with open doors that unite us in community and care for the planet, rather than isolating us in piles of our own dehumanized data. We are more than the sum of our digital exhaust. It is time that we began a campaign of non-cooperation before the blockchain catches up with us. For additional information, go to wrenchinthegears.com.